First of all.
Good evening. Honorable Minister for National Security, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Vidus Mamari, and on behalf of Center for Justice, I'd like to welcome you to our forum on the balance between public safety and liberty in the context of police double search powers. Before we begin this evening's program, I would like to say a few words about Center for Justice, as this is our first public forum. Center for Justice was founded in August earlier this year. We are an independent, non-government, non-profit, and non-partisan organization, and our mandate is to promote and protect the rule of law, human rights, and civil liberties in Bermuda. We believe that no other organization in Bermuda is fulfilling this important role. In order to achieve our goals, we will be engaging in wide-ranging activities. Short term, we will scrutinize legislation and policy to ensure that they are compatible with the Bermuda Constitution as well as international human rights treaties and conventions. We will inform and educate the public by publishing user-friendly legal briefings and guidance notes. And we will hold public forums and debates on fundamental human rights, including any legislation that may impact on those rights. We will also intervene as a third party in cases involving the protection of fundamental rights and provide specialist legal advice in cases where miscarriage of justice may have taken place. Center for Justice is hosting this forum pursuant to its mandate to inform and educate the public on the fundamental rights guaranteed by the Bermuda Constitution. We are privileged to have with us a distinguished panel of speakers and our exceptional moderator. Our first speaker will be the Honourable Lane Perrin, Chief Minister for National Security. Following his graduation from the Barclay Institute, he enjoyed a 30-plus year career with the Bermuda Police Service, during which time he earned his bachelor's degree in psychology from Queen's University in Ontario and his master's degree in management and human resource development from Webster University. In 1991, he earned the Colonial Police Medal for Meritorious Service, and following his retirement from the police service in 1995, he was elected to Parliament in 1998, where he served as Minister for National Drug Control and Cultural Affairs prior to his appointment in April of this year as the Minister for National Security. Next on our panel is Acting Police Commissioner Mike Jackman, who is the Deputy Police Commissioner. He has worked in many areas of policing since his arrival in Bermuda in 1982. He was also the chairman of the Bermuda Police Association from 1996 to 1999. In 1995, he was promoted to sergeant and in 2001 to inspector when he headed the Research, Development and Innovation Unit. He was promoted to chief inspector in 2004 and superintendent in 2006 when he became the head of the Narcotics Division. He became Deputy Commissioner in 2008. He holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Policing and Police Studies from the University of Portsmouth and has received extensive specialist training from several UK institutions. Next, we have Cordell Riley, who is Managing Director of Profiles of Bermuda, which he founded in 1998. His company conducts human resource assessments, training and development, as well as market, business and tourism research. He is a former government statistician and is a member of Endicott's adjunct faculty, and currently he is studying for his doctorate. He is also the president of CURB and he has an active interest in social and restorative justice. Next with us we have Carlton Simmons. He is the co-founder and president of Youth on the Move. After graduating from Northland Secondary School in 1995, he was one of the 3 out of 300 applicants to win the Belco Scholarship for Belco's four-year apprenticeship program. His passions are entrepreneurship, chess, and community activism. Next, we have Larry Mossenden. He is a former Crown Council prosecutor, Attorney General, and Minister of Justice. He was instrumental in bringing major reform to the current law legislation when he was the Attorney General. He is now a partner in his own law firm, Mossenden Sevier, where he specializes in criminal, civil, and commercial litigation. And last but not least, we have Peter Martin. He has led the International Corporate Practice Group since he joined Meadow Joseph Martin as a partner in 1991. He has practiced corporate and commercial law for more than 20 years and is recognized as one of the leading corporate lawyers in Bermuda. He takes an active interest in human rights and the rule of law issues. He completed a master's degree at the Center for the Study of Human Rights at the London School of Economics and Political Science in 2007. Our moderator is a well-known small regular broadcasting company, Rick Richardson. Rick has an extensive background in various aspects of media with a particular background in broadcast journalism. In his earliest stint in journalism, he hosted the very popular News on News program that aired on ZBN, and of course the program dealt with most of the hot-button topics of the day. I know he's looking forward to a very spirited and lively discussion this evening. Before I turn the floor to our panel, I would like to say a few words on behalf of Center for Justice. We decided to review the legislation on stop and search powers because we had become aware of several individuals, albeit by way of anecdote, who had been stopped and searched several times, and they did not appear to know why they were being stopped and searched, nor under what authority they were being stopped. We're all aware that in recent years, Bermuda has suffered an unprecedented wave of violent crime related to gangs. Center for Justice, like all right-thinking people in Bermuda, deplores this development and supports the police and the government in their efforts to end this destructive state of affairs. Nevertheless, we are concerned that some of the policies and practices adopted to address these issues may have the potential to lead to unintended consequences. The police have the power to stop and search people and vehicles under various pieces of legislation, such as PACE, the Misuse of Drugs Act, or the Criminal Code Act, so long as there are reasonable grounds for suspecting that they are carrying, for instance, stolen goods, drugs, or weapons. We do not take issue with these powers, and I repeat, we do not take issue with these powers. The stop and search powers that cause us great concern are those contained in Section 315F of the Criminal Code Act, which was introduced in 2005 and amended in 2010. The aim of Section 315F is to enhance the power of the police to stop and search in anticipation of violence. For the purpose of tonight's discussion, it is necessary to explain how Section 315 operates and to explain the law on the right to privacy. The powers conferred by this section can only be exercised at a place or locality that has been identified as a place where serious violence may take place. Authorization may be given by a police officer of or above the rank of inspector who reasonably suspects that incidents involving serious violence may take place in any locality and that it is expedient, I repeat, expedient, to give an authorization under this section to prevent their occurrence, or that persons are carrying dangerous instruments or offensive weapons in any locality without good reason. The initial period of authorization is 2 weeks. However, it may be extended for a further period of 1 month by an officer of or above the rank of superintendent if there are reasonable grounds for suspecting that an offence may have been committed in connection with any activity falling within the authorization. So what does the authorization mean? The authorization allows any police officer in uniform to stop and search any person or vehicle, driver and passenger alike, for offensive weapons and dangerous instruments within the geographical area covered by the authorization. Section 315F specifically allows the police officer to stop and search anyone or any vehicle he thinks fit, whether or not he has any grounds for suspecting that the person or vehicle is carrying weapons or articles of that kind. Our concern is how this provision impacts the Bermuda Constitution. Section 7 of the Constitution guarantees that we will not be subjected to a search of our person or our property without our consent or unless the search is authorized by the authority of law. Our right to privacy guaranteed by Section 7 of the Constitution is essentially aimed at protecting us against arbitrary arrest. Section 7 of the Bermuda Constitution goes on to say that the law in question will not be held inconsistent or in contravention of the law if it is reasonably required in the interest of public safety and public order. or for the purpose of protecting the rights and freedoms of others. So the question is whether Section 315F is reasonably required in legitimate interest or for legitimate purposes. In other words, is it necessary and is it proportionate to those legitimate aims? We say that Section 315F is not proportionate to the interest of public safety. We say that because Section 315F empowers a senior officer to authorize any police officer in uniform to search anyone or any vehicle in any area specified by him that falls within his jurisdiction if he considers it expedient for the prevention of crime. Expedient means no more than advantageous or helpful. There's no requirement at the authorization stage that the stop and search power be considered necessary. Remember, it's just expedient. Therefore, no requirement for any assessment of the proportionality of the measure. The second difficulty, and perhaps greater concern with the provisions of this section, is the breadth of the discretion conferred on the individual police officer. Not only is it not necessary for him to demonstrate the existence of any reasonable suspicion, he is not required even subjectively to suspect anything about the person or vehicle stopped and searched. In other words, provided that the person is stopped for the purpose of searching for such articles, the police officer does not even have to have grounds for suspecting the presence of such articles. There is therefore a clear risk of arbitrariness in the grant of such a broad discretion to the police officer. In the absence of any obligation on the part of the officer to show a reasonable suspicion, it is impossible to prove that the power was improperly exercised. In our view, the powers of authorization as well as those of stop and search under Section 315F are neither sufficiently restricted nor subject of adequate legal safeguards against abuse. Therefore, it is not in accordance with the law as required by the Constitution. We submit that Section 315F contravenes Section 7 of the Constitution on the basis that the authorization is based on mere expediency, not necessity, and the stop and search can be conducted without reasonable suspicion. Now, having said all that, I need to pause here and caution that Section 315F is the law of the land. If anyone resists the stop and search on the grounds that it contravenes the Constitution, the police can arrest you for resisting. Section 315F allows that. But the police have an obligation to apply and enforce the law. In closing, Centre for Justice remains steadfast in its mandate to protect the fundamental rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution. We say that our Constitution must be jealously safeguarded because any erosion of those rights would render all our constitutional rights irrelevant. We acknowledge that gang and gun violence must be properly addressed, but it is imperative that we do not opt out of the Constitution for the sake of expediency. We simply say that law enforcement practices must conform to our Constitution. The community wants to and has every right to live in a safe environment. But it appears to be divided on this issue. To that end, I'm pleased to turn the floor to our distinguished panel who will speak about their experiences with Section 315F and will further the discussion on how we may balance two important objectives, that is public safety whilst upholding the Bermuda Constitution.
Just before the Minister comes to make his remarks, you've just heard that detailed introduction. The panel will now lay out their arguments, and I say arguments because they will make the points that support or basically show some reservations to the measure. First, the Minister.
Good evening, and thank you for this to this audience for being part of such an important discussion. Let me first thank the Center for Justice and its Managing Director, Ms. Venus Mameri, for her kind invitation. These are challenging times for the criminal justice system. These are challenging times for communities and for ordinary citizens. The paradigm of crime has been transformed to one where at the root of every act of criminal or antisocial behavior, the label gang-related seems to arise. To meet the challenges of this age, the changed paradigm of crime must be met with an equally dynamic system of law enforcement. This means that governments must act firmly, effectively, and strike the appropriate balance between civil liberties and the need for public safety. The Bermuda Constitution is a child born of the mother of this nation, the late Dame Lewis Brown Evans. Her fight for justice and equality in this country is never far from the hearts and minds of those of us now in government. It is important that I say that because it provides a critical background to the rationale for the laws being debated tonight. This government does not take civil liberties for granted, and the history of our activism in this country is a story of social justice for all. The critics of the stop and search powers say that in addition to their extreme reach, the powers do not address the core social issues that underpin the dysfunction played out in society and manifested as criminal behavior. I agree. As the Minister for National Security, enforcement and policies aimed at promoting safer communities through the actions of the Bermuda Police Service is my business. In this respect, while I recognize the importance of the helping agencies and of the requirement to address the issues presented early and often, I cannot shy away from tough laws to meet equally tough behavior. Our Constitution contemplates scenarios where, for reasons of national security or public safety, actions must be taken which may offend against the general expectations of many citizens. Section 7 of the Constitution in particular uses language that we say makes the exercise of police power provided by the stop and search provisions legal. It is inaccurate to cast the stop and search laws as an absolute. The section contains specific safeguards that are designed to prevent the abuse of the power and speak to the nature of the provisions as being exceptional and not the norm. Just what are the safeguards and where are the checks and balances? Under 315F, a police officer of or above the rank of inspector, right off the reel, the immediate safeguard is that an officer of experience and with an assumed commensurate degree of responsibility is the one empowered to act under this section. Two, the terminology reasonably suspects means that violence may occur in a particular area. This test is also important because in the absence of a reasonable suspicion, the officer cannot act under this section. Keep in mind that violence may occur in a particular area. Three, that incidents involving serious violence may take place, not willy-nilly, but based upon intelligence and the fulfillment of the mandate to prevent such incidents taking place. So it's a preventative aspect in this 315F. And four, the powers are used for a specified period, and extensions to that period must be authorized higher up the rank structure by a superintendent. These are important safeguards which should provide comfort to the public. There is an important distinction that must be made, however. One of the complaints is that once these powers are activated, any person or vehicle is subject to stop and search. This is true. And the rationale in support of that premise is that the judgment exercised by the senior officer is based upon the intelligence surrounding the locality and not any specific individual. So if the area is problematic, and we know where those areas are, and some of you will probably quote them, check the page in reference, I'm sure that the acting commissioner has charts and graphs that demonstrate some of the statistics surrounding the use of this power.
Familiar with them. I recently referred to the public perception survey carried out to assess the public's views on the Bermuda Police Service. Those findings indicate an ever-increasing satisfaction with the performance of the police and a growing understanding within the community of the role that they have to play. People have made the connection between strong enforcement and public safety. Residents have accepted that the trend of violent crime must be met with strong action, and that in so doing, their interaction with the police may increase, but they understand what is at stake. 82% of residents believe that the police service should mainly focus on violent crime. That figure cannot be ignored. The laws we debate tonight were passed during a period that preceded the outbreak of gun violence on the scale we now see. But the powers are equally important in addressing this changed paradigm. In that regard, these laws can be said to be prudent and valuable in this mission to maintain public safety in Bermuda. Let me close my former remarks by stating clearly that this government's roots are in the labor movement, the fight for social justice, and for the equal treatment of all persons. Nothing in these laws detracts from those core values. The execution of these powers is intelligence-driven, and so the demographics of those affected are therefore likely to affect those who are involved. The race and gender of those who have been killed by or convicted of violent crime is a fact. It may well be for another forum to address the why with respect to those chilling statistics. It pains me to talk with mothers of these men who cannot accept their fate, no more than you or I could. If it were our own sons, my duty to secure Bermuda's communities for the peaceful enjoyment of the majority of its citizens who are law-abiding means that aggressive legal action by the police must be supported by the government. Too many examples of positive lifestyles go ignored, and poor choices are made by a minority of our people. Where those choices result in criminal activity, strong enforcement at all levels of the criminal justice system must demonstrate that there are consequences. I continue to support the police in the execution of their duties. The results are plain to see. All crime is down and continues to trend downwards when compared with the years since the noted spike. Public support of the police is up. Bermudian juries have convicted 10 people of violent crimes this year alone, and the courts have meted out stiff sentences to match the crimes committed. Our hope is that this situation will not last always, and that these powers will have the chance at some stage to gather dust and become obscure. In the meantime, however, we must do our duty. In so doing, I am satisfied that we are striking the correct balance between public safety and liberty. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. Just a note, jot down some of the questions. We're going to go through the panelists, and then we'll take your questions. The next speaker to do the submission will be the Acting Police Commissioner, Mr. Mike Jackman. He will be followed by the Managing Director of Profiles and the President of CURB, Mr. Cordell Riley.
Thanks. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. To the Center for Justice, thanks for having me on the panel tonight. But what I want to do in the 10 minutes or so that I've been allocated is just to put into context some of the numbers that you will see some of the numbers that you will see or hear as part of the discussion around stop and search. The constitutionality of the 315F is not really the job of the police to defend that, and our minister, I think, will set out the position on why that particular law was in place. But what my job is tonight is to try to put some context around the numbers that you will see and to explain where there's some doubt why we do what we do. And really, we have a very single-focused mission. We arrived at that mission in early 2010. We recognized that we must get our officers working to one standard, and that standard is making Bermuda safer. And what we need to do, what we needed to do, was to focus all of our staff on that one core mission, making Bermuda safer. We wanted communities to feel confident in the police. We wanted communities to reduce their fear of crime. And we wanted to make sure that our staff understood that robust enforcement didn't mean breaking the law to make the law. We wanted to make sure that our staff enforced the laws fairly and unbiasedly. We also wanted to make sure that we had the confidence and trust of the community. It's important to recognize the value of stop and search in what we've done in the last 18 months. A former Minister of National Security famously quoted, probably in mid-2009, that he wanted the police to stop tiptoeing through the oleanders and do their job. At that time, I wasn't the deputy commissioner and Mr. De Silva wasn't commissioner, but that message rang clear to us that what the government was saying to the police is there's a time for robust action and you need to take that action now to address crime as it started to increase. And they also challenged us to use the tools that they had provided through various legislations to make sure that we were tackling crime seriously, and one of them was stop and search. And stop and search has provided us with an opportunity to address some of the issues around gun violence and allowed us to be proactive in terms of addressing that violence. So a quick look at the stats, if we can go to slide 4. The first slide that you will see shows the all crimes, that's all crimes that have been committed in Bermuda. And if you look clearly, and you can see there's a dark green line and a light green line. And the light green line reflects the last three quarters. And you'll see the light green line is below the dark green line. The next graph looks at crimes against the person. That tends to be the crimes that are associated with firearms incidents, people getting injured, crimes against the person. Again, you'll see a steady decline between 2010 and 2011. The next chart you'll see identifies the total number of arrests between quarter 1, 2008 and quarter 3, 2011. Again, you will see a familiar decline in the number of arrests. The next slide is the slide that will get most of the discussion tonight. It is the stop and search statistics. Stop and search powers were first granted to the police, I believe it was 2007, after the famous incident at Wellington Oval. I think most people were appalled to see on their television screens guys with all kind of weapons running across Wellington Oval right after one of the major football games. And the government of the day passed legislation to allow the police to stop and search individuals that we reasonably suspected were carrying weapons intended to cause violence. And we used those powers. We used those powers from the time we were granted those powers and we apply them across the island based on the provisions of law. There's an important chart that I want you to have a look at, and that's the next chart. I might have to come back to the stop and search. But you look at that graph, and if you overlay that graph on top of the graph of stop and search, you'll see similarities. You'll see a very low application of stop and search in the years 2008, early part of 2009, and then you'll see a spike in firearms incidents in 2010 and the beginning of 2011, and conversely, you'll see the same spike in stop and search. You'll see for the last quarter and a bit that those firearms incidents have gone down, and what you'll see on the stop and search form, can you go backward? On the stop and search form, is that stop and search form is going down. What that shows is that in the police, we don't take the powers that are granted to us frivolously. We understand that, you know, we're the guardians of people's civil liberties when it comes to crime and disorder, and we recognize that, you know, we have a lot of powers, but the job certainly of senior command is to make sure that our officers, we want them to be robust in terms of dealing with the criminals, but we have people that we want on our side. If we alienated everybody in the community, we'll never solve crime. And as a particular tactic, we recognize building public confidence is important to solving crime. And we spend a lot of time at the beginning of 2007 teaching our officers about problem-oriented policing so that when they go into communities, they're building community confidence, not distracting from community confidence. So if you go to slide number 10, you'll have a look quickly at public perception study that we commission every quarter. We start in April and we do a big public perception, and then we continue to check in every quarter to see where we are in terms of how the public feel about us. And it's important to have a look at that chart, and you'll see that 58% of the people that were surveyed were completely satisfied with the police's performance. There's another 30% that were somewhat satisfied. They weren't dissatisfied. They were somewhat satisfied. And if you look on the chart, you'll see that it's 11 that weren't satisfied with the way police are doing their business. Again, we use these gauges to understand whether or not we are doing the right things and whether the community that we police or that police along with us are supporting what we're doing. So we're not trying to do things in a vacuum. We want to see how the public feels. If the public's saying you guys are too harsh, you're too heavy-handed, we're going to take note of that as a senior command, and we will address our tactics accordingly. But that's not what the public is saying at the end of October 2011. They're saying, we want you to keep doing what you're doing because we're satisfied. 88% are saying we're satisfied. And if you're looking at the reasons, next slide, please. If you're looking at the reasons why people are dissatisfied with the police. I'm not sure if you can see that there. I've got even difficulty reading mine. But those that are dissatisfied really think we're not doing enough about serious crime. So of the people who are dissatisfied with us, the majority are dissatisfied because they're saying, you're not doing enough about serious crime. So 88% are saying, you're doing a good job, and we're satisfied. 11% are saying we're not satisfied. And 30% of that 11 is saying we're dissatisfied because you're not doing enough about serious crime. So they're saying we need you to do more. We listen to this stuff in our decision making. We listen to this stuff. If you can go to the next slide, please. And we review the public satisfaction survey every quarter to make sure that we're on the right track in terms of how we apply stop and search, how we apply any of the other powers that are given to us by the legislature, to make sure that the people that we police are with us. We can't police Bermuda on our own. We solve crime because members of the public see stuff happening, they report it to us. We solve crime when members of the public are willing to come and give evidence in court, even at the risk of harm to themselves and their families, to make sure we get convictions and to make sure that we had the 15 convictions we had for firearms-related crime in the last 2 years. That didn't happen by osmosis. That happened because the public said, we're going to support you, and we're going to support you 101% because we are tired of living in fear. And it's the job of the police to make the community not live in fear. And our job is to apply the laws that are given to us by the government. And it's the job of senior command to make sure that when we send our officers out, they understand the context of which they need to apply those rules and those laws, so that we are not roughshod over people's rights. We do our job, and we do it to achieve a goal, and we don't run roughshod over people's rights. The last slide actually looks at the satisfaction index, which is about 59%, which is the mean index score for satisfaction. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure there'll be questions about stop and search and how stop and search is applied, and I'll be willing to answer any questions that are forwarded. I've got some of my senior command here with me that if I can't answer, they'll be willing to help me to answer some of the questions that you might have. Thank you.
Just a note, I've been told, Mr. Acting Commissioner, that those stats are also available on your website. Yep, good. And also for those attending, there's a number of pamphlets at the back that will have some word on the law and other items. So feel free to get that either on your way out, for sure. Let's bring forward now Mr. Cordell Riley.
Good evening. I just want to thank to the minister and invited guests. I want to thank the Center of Justice for inviting me here today to say brief words about our view, and I mean our CURB, Citizens Upholding Racism in Bermuda. That's the hat I'm wearing, so I will speak to it from that aspect. What the acting, the deputy commissioner just showed you were the stop and search figures and showing the increase and the decline. What's interesting is that if you look at the figures in totality, what I can find from their website, there were, I think in 2008, there were less than 1,000 stop and searches. There were 3,700 in 2009. There were just under 9,500 in 2010. There are 14,500 stop and searches by the third quarter of this year, and I estimate that if that trend continues, there will be about 19,000 stop and searches or engagements for 2010. What is the impact of that? Well, the reality is that of those figures, 90% are black, and 85% are male. Now let's drill down those data a little bit further. The entire male population of 18 to 36 year olds is approximately 6,000. Take out the white males, and you're leaving at about roughly 3,500. Out of those searches, 64% are between the ages of 18 and 36. So when you look at it from that perspective, what you'll find is that theoretically, I'm just speaking theoretically, every black male between the ages of 18 to 36 could be stopped four times. Now we know there's a lot of double counting in those data, and so therefore we know that there are people being stopped five, six, seven, and eight times. I don't know if you heard the talk show today, one person called in and said he had been stopped five times. I've spoken to a number of people who have been stopped more than five times. None of them have been arrested. So the question that I would put forward is, what is the impact of stopping so many people? How many people were arrested? How many were found with guns? How many were found with other illegal paraphernalia? What is the correlation? What is the causality of so many searches? In other words, could you be as effective by stopping less? The figures that were just shown doesn't show us that. It doesn't prove causality. It shows that people are happy with what they're doing. If you were to stop, if there was in the paper tomorrow morning that the police found three guns tonight, of course everybody would be cheering. But do you have to stop and search 20,000 or have engagements with 20,000 people in 1 year? What are you building up? What is the resentment that's coming? I talked to one male. He said after being stopped five times, he has to almost just humble himself because he's so angry. And it's if it's in one of these areas, which is designated under 315F, he says he lives there. What is he supposed to do? So every time it's designated as a hot spot, the likelihood is that he's going to be picked up. Now, obviously he would like to move out, but that's where he is. So we're concerned about the impact that this could be having and what it could be breeding or manufacturing down the road. We sort of bring in this power to stop one thing, and then we're creating another problem which you might have to face down the road. Now, we know that the Section 315F, and my learned friend Larry could correct me if I'm wrong, that information, that section of the Act came out of the 1994 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act in the UK. Interestingly enough, similar wording was found in the 2000 UK Terrorism Act, which is a similar wording to what we have in our law. And the funny thing is that in 2010, the European Court of Justice threw out the powers of stop and search under the Terrorism Act for not the first time, the second time. And I'll just read you what it says here. The European Court of Human Rights has officially ruled police stop and search powers under UK terrorism laws illegal for the second time, rejecting a government appeal. We've had a legal opinion, and we have the same opinion with regards to the Central Justice, that we feel that the stop and search powers under 315F are excessive, and that the police force have sufficient powers under 2006 PACE Act in order to do the job. As a social justice organization, we are very concerned about what could be creating by having all these people engaged and no evidence to show that these laws are actually working. Thank you very much.
As you can see, the lines are clearly drawn. Let's hear from the co-founder and president of Youth on the Move, Mr. Carlton Simmons.
Thank you very much. Good evening. Our protocol having already been established. Just would like to thank the Center for Justice for allowing me to speak. Basically, I want to speak tonight in my capacity as a director of Youth on the Move, and probably try to put a human face on the social and long-term effects to the people that are affected by this particular law. Firstly, Youth on the Move is a youth and young adult serving agency, which aims to provide direct services, outreach, and advocacy toward youth-related issues. Basically, what that means is that our job is to make sure that there's a voice out speaking to the needs that affect youth and young adults. We believe and we know that there exists a formula for producing productive youth and young adult citizens, and our goal is to make sure that all the stakeholders, in particular government and agencies that affect the outcomes of young people, are made aware of the things that are affecting young people negatively, and so that we can adjust those things and make sure that we have the outcome that we desire. What are the social consequences of robust policing and the long-term effects? We believe that when you give the types of powers that you've given to the police service, that you have to counter those powers with equally strong countermeasures. For example, equally strong community agencies, equally strong watchdog groups, and an informed and engaged public. And so one of the issues that we have with Stop and Search is that we have given an extreme amount of power to the police, certainly for Bermuda and what it's used to seeing, but we have not strengthened the agencies that could be or should be watchdogs. For example, PACE was introduced with very little to no public input or awareness of the act. I remember seeing it in the paper. I read it. I was quite concerned about it. But very few people knew then and probably know now what it entails. Community groups, making sure that they have the resources and the tools they need to inform not only the police and the government and the rest of the community what exactly is transpiring as a result of these types of laws. And my colleague O'Neill will speak to instances where we've had to take away laws because the residual effects of that law have been so negative that they actually outweigh the effects of what they intended to do. And so I think that this is one of the points I'm going to try to make tonight. So again, we wanted to make sure our position is that we have not yet strengthened the watchdog agencies. For example, the external police investigation or external agency that is a watchdog for the police. They don't have the budget that they need to actually do an adequate job when it comes to issues of abuse of power or those things of that nature. And so whose job is it to make sure that those types of agencies have the resources they need as we boost up the powers and the budgets of the police? Are we making sure that the agencies responsible for oversight and making sure that there's no abuse of power and those types of things are equally made adequate and the legislation to support that? What happens if you don't get it right, exactly right? Again, we're talking about the abuse of power. My colleague Cordell spoke about some of the stats, so I don't need to go over those again. But what about the negative effect on the people that is not intended? So again, we're looking for a handful of people running around with guns and whatnot. We're stopping 4, 5, 6 times, basically the entire 18 to 35-year-old adult population, male population, and what is the effect of that? I'll give you an example. I was pulled over on South Shore just past the South Shore gas station. I was traveling alone, playing my music. I was flagged down, asked to get out of my car, put my hands on the bonnet. I was patted down, then my car was supplicantly searched. Now, in my work as a community agent, I understand that that is part of their job. But what did disturb me, and I think that brings the issue home, is that I saw two other gentlemen get pulled over and stopped. So I didn't see any females, and I didn't see any white male or females get pulled over. One individual had his girlfriend in the car, and one individual had his child in the car. And so you have to ask yourself, what are the effects, not only on the parent, but on the child, that you're just driving along on a Sunday, this happened to be a Sunday, coming from wherever you're coming from, police pull you over for no apparent reason other than that they're doing their job, and you are asked to get out of your car, your search and whatnot, your child observes this, your girlfriend sees this. What are the effects on those people that are in the vehicle, and particularly the child and the girlfriend? And so these are the types of things that we're talking about. Now, when you take into consideration, this may happen several times to an individual. What does that say to that individual in the long term? Another thing that we have noticed through data and just reporting, that a lot of times people get caught and they may have, say, for example, marijuana in their possession. Now, we have some data on it. I believe 66% of the young people that we surveyed said they had used marijuana. Only 33% said they still use marijuana. I bring this up because in Bermuda, you can be pulled over in a stop and search, and they're looking for weapons, and if you have something as little as a joint. Now, again, I'm not advocating for marijuana. What I'm trying to draw a parallel between the long-term effects. And The police in their duties, rightfully so, take you to the police station, book you for that. Eventually your name ends up in the paper and you end up on a stop list. So you can get a 16-year-old, a 17-year-old, 18-year-old being denied travel to the United States for the rest of their life because they were caught up in a scenario where they were carrying a small amount of illegal substance, and the penalty for that ends up being that their chances of studying abroad in the U.S., being able to travel to Canada, are completely wiped out. Now, I bring that up to say this. We've had extensive discussions about this with the consulate, and right now there exists no laws that allow the consulate to not do their job and their due diligence. The point being that our children are being held at a standard that most kids in other countries would not be held to. Three out of the last four presidents have all acknowledged that they've experimented with drugs in some way, shape, form, or another, but yet they've been able to go on and become presidents. I don't think that the stop and search law is intended to have this effect on young black men or young men in particular, but this is the effect it is having. And so we need to step back and ask ourselves, is this what we want to happen? Because if out of 7,000 young men, 3,500 of them, and then the odds of them getting caught are very high, and then as a result, travel is denied, criminal records. There's another statistic we have showing that 50% of those surveyed have been arrested and incarcerated, but only 25% have been convicted of a crime. So I think that also speaks to the fact that people are being introduced to the criminal system, but not actually, so to speak, criminals. And so we want to speak to that and say, is that our intention? Because years to come, when majority of our boys are still unable to travel, unable to get a college degree, unable to get the exposure that they would need to become productive citizens, then what do we have? We have parents, we have fathers, we have husbands who can't take the children to travel. There's all sorts of residual effects, and my objective tonight is to make sure that those things equally get addressed. Lastly, the data. It's easy to get good data when you're surveying the people that are not affected by the actual act. So if 90% of the people being pulled over are young black men between the age of 18 and 35, and you're surveying the entire population, most of who have never gotten pulled over by it, but they just see the headlines or they think it's working, of course they're going to like it. And so it's not about the data is skewed or it's not relevant, but again, who's speaking for the individuals who are directly affected by it? And we're not talking about the criminals. We're not talking about the 1 or 200 people that the police are actually looking for. I'm talking about those other 3,000 and plus people who are being affected by this negatively, and their families are being affected by it negatively, and their children are being affected by it negatively. And lastly, Bermuda cannot afford to continue on this path. The real impact to young black men, the impact on the family, and to the long-term health of Bermuda is at stake. So it's not enough to say, you know, we did this for the sake of gang violence. If we look up 10 years from now, 15 years from now, and we've eroded away the fabric of our families because of it. Thank you.
So we have two more speakers, and then we let you, the audience, in on it, and it's quite intriguing. So, former Attorney General and Minister of Justice, Mr. Larry Mussenden.
Mr. Minister, panel, it's always funny, you know, when you get out of politics, they always refer to you as the former something. You know, they never actually say what you do now, right? But be that as it may, I'm always introduced as the former something or the other. But in any event, I want to just spend about no more than 5 minutes. And if I cross 5 minutes, if somebody could just wave so I know that it's 5 minutes, and then I'll sit down because I think the floor should get involved in everything. I would like to put the whole section 315 in context, and that is, I think, a few years ago when I was the Attorney General, decided that we wanted to have a review of the criminal justice system. And some of the participants of that are in this room. And so I'm glad to say the former Attorney General, Mr. Phil Parenteau, is here in the room. So he was involved in the criminal justice system review. And then also Minister Horton, who is here this evening, he was very involved in piloting the legislation through the House. And as far as PACE and some of the upgrades to the criminal legislation was, I remember calling Commissioner Jonathan Smith at the time, and he's here this evening as well. I called him. I said, I'd like to have a meeting with you. He said, sure. So he came down to the office, and I said, listen, you know, a lot of things going on. We want to upgrade the criminal justice system and really looking at some of the legislation. And he says, well, yeah, I have those ideas too, and I would like to make some changes as well. And so I said, well, I'm thinking about PACE. And he pulled out a few sheets of paper, and he said, well, I'm thinking about PACE, too. And so we hit it off right from there, because he said that a police officer who's 19 years of age, becoming a first-time police officer, has to learn just a ton of different laws when it comes to dealing with the stopping and searching of people in the streets, the detention of people, the treatment in the police station, the questioning, and all of those kinds of things. So that was one of the ways that we got started. Then working with Minister Horton at the time, we then had to get cracking with a whole review and then a raft of legislation. That legislation was the legislation PACE, of which we probably had about 100 meetings or so in PACE. Some of the police officers that are in the room remember sitting in on the committees that dealt with PACE and adapting it to Bermuda. We took the Theft Act out of the UK. We modernized the Theft Act in Bermuda. Well, it's actually the Criminal Code, but the whole Theft Act from the United Kingdom pulled and stuck into our criminal code here in Bermuda. A Bail Act, which we had never had before, we put that in place. Another thing that we abolished in our review was the special jurors. That's, for instance, like if there's going to be a complex fraud case, instead of just using the average layperson to be a juror, what that did was allowed the Crown, or in fact allowed the court, to pick jurors who had certain qualifications, like being accountants or professionals, as opposed to lay people. And my information at the time, because I was the AG at the time, was that was a special jury was actually going to be used to try Mr. Julian Hall. But we had, and they weren't connected, but we actually abolished the special jurors just shortly before that time that his trial came up. And as I say, they weren't connected. The other thing was bladed weapons. We brought in the law about bladed weapons and the mandatory sentencing. And then also the Section 315 Act. So that is really the context. And I will say this much. At that time and since then, I believe that bringing in that whole raft of legislation actually helped to save lives in Bermuda. And I think that's very important for people to remember, particularly in the context of this this forum tonight, which speaks about the balance between liberty and also safeguarding the community. So I know there are a lot of people who are either police and also just members of the community who have been the beneficiaries of that. Now, that was then. So now I'm the former Attorney General, and I am now a defense lawyer. So now, you know, what do I do? I'm invited here to be a criminal defense lawyer to actually argue against all of that stuff, right? So, but I have to say this. Having come back now into the criminal defense world, I am now able to say that going to the Hamilton Police Station or any of the police stations, I certainly see better conditions for people who are in custody. I see better treatment of people who are suspects. I see better lineup parades. They use something called ProMat, which is much better than what it used to be before, where people used to witness would have to interact with possible suspects. They use videotape caution interviews. There's absolute disclosure. It really just knocked me off my feet when I actually got the disclosure, which is automatic. Before, you had to beg the police and the prosecutors to get the statements in the case. These days, it's automatic. You go to court, and they're handing you the statements right there. And so I have to say this, that there seem to be timely investigations, better disclosure, and I also have to say, and I'm not being paid by the police, but there seems to be better quality of policing and investigation by the police. And so that results in having better trials and timely trials compared to years ago where a person could be in custody for years before they actually got to court. Now, and I'm not going to be talk about the record that my firm has with getting acquittals and not guilties and no case submissions, but, you know, there's some policemen here, and I want to say that, you know, even today, my firm was able to deliver no case. Hey, somebody's clapping. Look at that. But in any event, I'm not going to go there because that's not what I'm here for. But the thing is, as I said, I'm not going to go there. So now I'm going to just quickly switch. I'll now quickly switch to that context, right, to the things about like Section 31F and about our Constitution. So the director, she pointed out the various parts of the Constitution that could be offended by this particular section. So we have things like no person shall be deprived of their personal liberty, protection for privacy, no person shall be subject to search of his person or his property. And so we have to now think about this 315 and then think, well, actually, is it impacting on our constitutional rights? Well, say all of that. I can tell you that my nephew went 16 the other day, and I sat him down, and having listened to the statistics, I said to him, and he is black, and he's about 6'3" or something like that. And I said to him, you are going to be stopped, and you are going to be searched. And then for the next half hour, I talked to him about what all of his rights were. So it is a situation that you as parents or as adults or guardians actually have to deal with, because it can go from being a very easy situation where the 16-year-old or the 17-year-old is going about his business, and then the next thing, and Larry Scott would like this, what traditionally happens is it's the next thing is failing to give your name and address, arrested, and then violently resisting arrest. All of those things kind of go together. So those are the things that could actually happen. So I had that conversation. With my nephew just to talk to him about all of those things and how he needs to conduct himself if that ever happens to him. Now, I come back to the Constitution part and to the aspects about this particular section. Now, there's a case that I think the director was speaking about, and it's a case of Gillen. Gillen is a case that was dealt with. It went to the European courts. It started in London, and it went to the High Court there, and then it went to the House of Lords. And Gillen is a case that actually involves two people who brought an action in the courts because they had been stopped and searched. There was an arms weapons fair that was going on in East London, and there was a demonstration against that. And so a number of people were going there. But the police, the Met police in London then declared that this was going to be an area where they would put this similar provision in place. And so one person was a student. Gillen was a student. He was a PhD student. And so he was walking there. He got stopped for about 5 minutes and went through the whole process where he was searched. Another person was a reporter. The reporter was found, didn't know that the person was a reporter at the time, but the reporter was found coming out of some bushes, and that reporter was then stopped. And although the police say the search was only for about 5 minutes, the search itself was for about 30 minutes, according to the reporter. Well, we know what reporters are like, so that's how we go from 5 to 30 minutes. But in any event, 5 minutes and 30 minutes. And so what happened was, and it's interesting the time frame, because that 5 minutes is up? Okay, give me two more minutes. Is it really five? All right. Is it 10? All right, let me hurry up and finish. Okay, this is it, because it fits in Bermuda. So that happened in 2003. That's a reporter, so you know, that means it's only 5 minutes. So in any event, that happened in 2003. Now, the legislation in Bermuda came in place in 2005. Now, the legislation, when it came in effect in Bermuda in 2005, actually said that you can put this in place for just 24 hours. And the test was, for the policeman that was going to give the authority, was that he had to reasonably believe that there was going to be something going on to put this in place, right? So that's 2005. Then this case made it to the House of Lords in 2006. And then it made it to the European courts in 2010. But here in Bermuda in 2010, the government then changed it to do two things. One, the 24-hour period got extended to 2 weeks. And the other part was that, you know, reason to believe, that's a little bit higher. That's a pretty high standard, not as high as a lot of other standards that we have in the criminal law, but for that purpose, it was reasonably believed. But in 2010, when they extended the provision of the authority to 2 weeks, they also downgraded the standard from reasonably believed to reasonably suspect. Now, policemen know this, and members of the public and of the audience, you will know as well the difference between believing and suspecting. So that's actually what happened. But when it came to the Constitution, now when you stop and search somebody, first of all, is it a deprivation of your liberty? Have I actually stopped you from going somewhere? And so whether it's for 5 minutes or for 30 minutes, right, well, we all know you actually are stopped. And so the courts had to deal with that issue. And to make a very long story short, they felt that that was not a deprivation of liberty just by stopping you. Okay, you weren't handcuffed and taken somewhere else, all of those kinds of things. That comes later if there's an offense. But they found that that wasn't a breach of the Constitution of the European Convention, similar to the Bermuda ones. And then the other one was about the privacy of the person. Okay, and so as far as the privacy of the person, the search part then became the issue. So I've stopped you, not an issue, but the search part, they then found, because of like some of the statistics here, that that actually could be an abuse. I believe they found that it was an abuse because the director said that, you know, or Cordell said about the cases and that the law was actually And so that's where the real issue comes from about the actual search. And then also the fact that imposing this is very arbitrary because it's a policeman that now reasonably suspects that something's going to go on. You put it into place, and then it's the policeman on the street who have to then go out and execute it. And then they're the ones that do all the stopping and the searching. And so what the court was concerned with was, well, hang on, is this arbitrary? And yes, probably it is arbitrary. Are there some guidelines that can be used to say who should be searched and who shouldn't? Well, you've heard the statistics about who in Bermuda is getting searched. And then other things that we normally have in our criminal law, which is reasonable suspicion to do something. So in PACE and in our other laws is always reasonable suspicion. And this one is kind of diluted down. So those are some of the things from the cases. Now, I would say this much. There's no Bermuda case yet that has made its way up. Okay, whether or not that European case is binding on us, we'll have to find out because there's been no case that's gone from the magistrate's court where this has happened. So nobody who's been stopped has actually brought a court case for it to be determined in Bermuda to see if the European case would apply. And then we haven't been to the Privy Council, and we don't have a Privy Council case yet. So is the first one waiting? We'll have to see. Oh, we had the first one here.
Last but not least in the presentations, lawyer and partner at the firm Mellow Jones and Martin, Mr. Peter Martin. Pete.
Good evening, everyone. Many of you will have heard of the great Judge Lord Denning. He was a judge with a special facility for communicating the essence of complicated ideas to ordinary people in a way that resonated with them. It was a uniquely gifted judge. After the Second World War, he gave a series of talks in the Hamlin lecture series called Freedom Under the Law. And I want to read you two short passages from that because I think that certainly they are resonant, but I think they are also kind of relevant to some of the things that we are discussing tonight. The first one, every society must have the means to protect itself from marauders. It must have powers to arrest, to search, and to imprison those who break the laws. So long as those powers are properly exercised, they are themselves the safeguards of freedom. But powers may be abused, and if those powers are abused, there is no tyranny like them. It leads to a state of affairs when the police may arrest any man and throw him into prison without cause assigned. It leads to the search of his house and belongings on the slightest pretext or on none. It leads to the hated Gestapo and the police state. The second passage that I wanted to read you. There we go. In the Hamlin lectures, in this series of lectures, Denning was trying to explain to the common people of England, as he referred to them, why they were so privileged. And he said that the wonderful heritage they had was freedom under the law. And this passage is under the heading Police Powers. If the police should overstep the mark and arrest a man when they have no lawful authority to do so, he has the same rights as against the police as he would have against any private individual who unlawfully arrested him. He is entitled to resist the unlawful arrest, if need be, by force. If a ticket collector or a policeman tried to arrest a passenger for travelling without paying his fare, when he was willing to give his name and address, he would be entitled to knock them down rather than go with them. If he submitted to the arrest and went, he would be entitled to obtain his immediate release by means of a writ of habeas corpus, and after obtaining his release, he would be entitled to bring an action for damages against them for false imprisonment. The reason I mention these things is that it's about the context. Obviously, our ideas of freedom change, our ideas of public safety change, but the provision that we are dealing with does not require, and I just read this to you, this is from the Act, a police officer may, in the exercise of the powers conferred by subsection 4, stop any person or vehicle and make any search he thinks it, whether or not he has any grounds for suspecting that the person or vehicle is carrying weapons or articles of that kind. So there's no need for suspicion. That is a national emergency power. It's the kind of power that you have when you are at war, or when there is an actual threat of terrorism, or something of that kind. It is not the kind of power that historically has been used. If you look at the Firearms Act 1967 in the UK, for example, the police were entitled to stop and search someone if they had reasonable grounds for a suspicion that they were carrying firearms. There's a well-established method of dealing with these things. Now, as I said, the context of the construction of freedom and of public safety changes, and we have to change with it. You can't rely on a handful of lawyers or judges to deal with this alone. Community participation is essential, particularly given Bermuda's social history. And what I would say to you is that we need the constructive genius of ordinary men and women to negotiate how we handle these problems in the community. You do not want to leave it to the courts. Again, an illustration of this, a survey of the English case law between 1915 and 1945, obviously the war years, where there was legislation passed dealing with civil or political rights. In no case was that legislation construed by the judges in a way that restrained the government. On the contrary, it went the other way. So the famous judgment of Lord Atkin, where he said that the judges were more executive-minded than the executive. So you cannot rely on the judges. And the United States experience is the same. Professor Lawrence Tribe of Harvard University, he says, historically, the judiciary has been so deferential to the executive in wartime as to provide virtually no meaningful check. It would be a terrible mistake for those who worry about civil rights and liberties to pin too much hope on the judiciary in times of crisis. So what I'm saying to you is this is a community problem and not a legal problem. There can be and unconstitutional law as a technical matter, then it can be implemented in a way that does not, in fact, offend the spirit of the Constitution, and vice versa. I'm now going to sort of change gears and look at a different subject. It's this rather deceptive metaphor of balance. Public safety and liberty are not equivalent values. There isn't a sort of zero-sum game where if you have less liberty, you have more safety, or vice versa. Not all rights are equal, and when you start down the road of redistributing rights, that may actually work unequally, and it may have an unfair impact, as has been mentioned earlier, on some parts of the community. Are we trading away something important, the liberties of the few, for the security of the many? And what are the unintended effects of a reduction in liberty? There's something that we are not seeing or saying tonight, and I say this with the greatest respect to the police and to the government. But there is also, when this rebalancing occurs, there is a transfer of power to the state and to the police. And it would be naive of us to think that security against gun crime is the only thing that that increased power can or will be used for. Power is endemically liable to abuse. History teaches us that, and as I say, I intend no disrespect on casting aspersions by saying that. It is just what history teaches us. I have just a couple more points. Where is the data, and is it the sort of data that we actually need? Are liberties being traded away for a symbolic security, or is there an actual measurable increase in the number of weapons being found? Are records being kept in such a way that we can determine that having made this decision to adjust the law, it's worthwhile? We can't trade away protections that blood was shed for just to achieve something, for something that is illusory, because it will be the devil's own job to get the power adjusted again. Now, this power is said to enhance the ability of the police to fight gun crime. But an enhanced ability to fight gun crime is not the same as a reduction in the threat of gun crime. We are normalizing measures that were developed in respect of terrorism. That they are becoming, we've gone from one day to 14 days. Is there a reliable record of whether or not these powers are being used in respect of weapons? That is the only basis on which this power may be used. And it does seem to me that if you are, on the one hand, are acting on intelligence, that you shouldn't need to have zones frequently designated as hotspots for periods of 2 weeks. It sounds to me that this is a power that is very useful, but it may not, in fact, be being used on the basis of real intelligence. I don't know that. I'm not saying that, but I think we do need to take into account that this power that is being used was introduced only to deal with terrorism in the UK, and prior to its introduction, the rule was that there was a need for there were reasonable grounds for suspicion So we have thrown out that safeguard. And the reason that safeguard is important is because it requires the officer on the spot to be accountable. He is making a decision about whether to exercise the power, and he should be able to say why he did so, not just because of how someone looks or so on. Anyway, thank you.
Well, gentlemen, very absorbing. I think Peter poises things very nicely to where we want to go. Do the ends justify the means? Are we at war? Are we at war? As we got started a little late, I want to open the floor very quickly, rather than my asking a question, and you can be specific, directed to the panel as a whole, or you can ask a specific question for someone individual. Yes? And the mics are in the aisles, and you can come to the mics. Yes?
Very focused on this issue for the last 9 months, and we've had the opportunity to meet with the Minister and with the Attorney General and with the Commissioner of Police and the Commissioner of Prisons, and we've done a lot of research into it. And I was interested in what Mr. Mustard said about the European Human Rights Court, and we're aware of that case with Quinlan that he mentioned. And in particular, that Section 315F is the issue of that, is the thing that CURB has a real issue with. 2006 PACE Act has sufficient powers, has that reasonable suspicion clause in it. There's enough power in that act. We don't need Section 315F
anymore. I'm not quite sure why such a stringent law was put in place in the first place when it was sort of very similar to a Terrorism Act law, maybe not exactly the same. But I think now, instead of going to the Privy Council, instead of going through the European Human Rights Courts, instead of dragging this through the courts, I would hope that the government would think about maybe looking at these two pieces of legislation and saying, is it any longer do we need that Section 315F? Another thing I think I would like to just suggest is everybody knows that when somebody's about to build something on a place that's designated environmentally protected, there's an environmental impact assessment done. What I would like to know is why aren't we doing an equality impact assessment for any legislation that is brought into this country? Because if you just lift out legislation straight out of the UK and plagiarize it or cut and paste it or whatever you want to do and plonk it into our legislation, it is going to have unintended consequences, just like Mr. Martin said. And I think I don't think there was any intention, but I do think that we have to be very open to the fact that there are unintended consequences playing out.
Okay, so
I would just like to say, is there a possibility of having equality assessment?
All right, I think the Minister can address that. Is this too early to be thinking about an amendment to the amendment? Mike's alive.
I've just consulted with the Acting Commissioner of Police. This Section 315F came into play, I think it was 2007, which indicates that there was perhaps not an intention to employ it immediately. And it hasn't been until latterly, I would say, as late as 2010, that it has been enforced in any rigorous way. Therefore, to me, there has to be an element of pragmatism. In other words, the law is not being abused. It's being used for a specific reason. And that pragmatism in itself means that it can be applied vigorously or turned on, if you like, depending on the element of threat. As you can see, it is applied periodically when there's a threat, and when the threat abates, then the necessity to use it falls away. Therefore, since the threat that we perceive is not abating at an appreciable rate, and we can anticipate it in the future, I do not see that the government will be making any amendments in the short term.
All right. Nothing to stop you from having a follow-up to that. We'll recognize Mr. Scott in a minute. Gentlemen.
Yes, good evening. Mr. Panjiv, when you were in opposition, I don't know if you remember, that when the Honorable David Searle was the premier of this country, and I presented a petition to the premier about decriminalization of marijuana, and the PLP was all in favor of that petition when they were in opposition. I had went to the Hamilton Police Station under the former police commissioner, Mr. Smith, smoking a joint outside of Hamilton Police Station. They told me that they're not going to arrest me because I was dealing with decriminalization. He told me to go up to the post office and smoke my spliff. The police had caught me with 0.3 grams of marijuana. I went to court and wanted to take my case to Supreme Court to argue my decriminalization.
Now, I know at some point you're going to come to this area we're working
yes,
on now.
Yes, but we wouldn't
you're
be...
You're getting there, yes, so I've just been
yes,
patient.
We wouldn't Wait. Have to deal with this PACE issue if the PLP and the UBP at the time would have dealt with the issue when they appointed Jerome Deal and Critton Agnes to have a study on decriminalization, and then they sanctioned the Honorable David Searle and put him out of office dealing right. with this issue. If we would have dealt with that issue way back then, we won't need this PACE legislation and everything else that it impacts upon our rights.
All right.
Because I've been stopped so many times that I can tell you that the police and now don't even stop me no more, because I've been to court enough times over a little piece of weed, and I'm telling you that this legislation, this PACE legislation, it should not come this far if these people had guts back then to deal with this issue.
All right. Mr. Horton
has encouraged me. Mr. Panjiv had encouraged me. And now that they're in a position 20 years later and we're still dealing with this issue.
Okay. Minister, that's pretty straightforward. He's without you talking and speaking to it, he's not just implied, he stated outright, if this decriminalization matter would have been dealt with, we wouldn't have the rest of this. And I, nice story, good story, maybe a little simplistic on the other side, because we're dealing with some other matters also. Anyone else? Question? Yes, this time. And then... gentlemen there, and
Thank
then
you.
Lady.
Thank you, Rick. A statement and a question. Minister and Mr. Jackman. Minister, when you look out at this audience, you will see people whom you always see at these kinds of meetings, and these are your progressive thinking-minded people. But for the boys in blue that seem to have come out to support Mr. Jackman this evening in large numbers.
Three-line whip.
A three-line whip, indeed. But here's the point, Minister. You've heard Mr. Simmons, what he said, particularly regarding, had we been considering the changes to drug legislation that you now have on the books, or recategorizing those laws, had you done that before you had come to PACE, you wouldn't have been able to have created those people that Mr. Simmons talks about, that large group of men who have now been put on stop lists and the like, you seem to have gotten the cart before the horse. The question is, are you prepared to listen to the progressive minds of Bermuda who have suggested to you that if you do the front-end work first, if you deal with helping our young men by not decriminalizing or criminalizing them so early, that you won't have to have them in the difficult position that Mr. Simmons has so adequately described their plight to be. Can you give us an assurance that you will deal with those areas of progressive thinking in your decisions more often than is done?
I'm trying to ascertain from that what the actual question is. It sounds like it may be a chicken and egg situation where I'll be prepared to deal with the underlying causality of the criminality. Is that what you were
suggesting? No. I mean, for example, I'm certain from your statement and Mr. Jackman's, I think you believe honestly that you're doing the right thing. Genuinely so. I don't think you're a man that sets out to get rid of civil liberties, but the unintended consequences of your actions are, for example, that you don't do the act that recategorizes drugs or drug convictions so as to protect young men, but you do the hard-nosed stuff where you pick them up, and you can pick them up for under stop and search, find a piece of weed on them, and lock them up, or have them decriminalized. You've got to begin thinking differently about how you approach crime. Can you give us an assurance, this progressive audience, that you will begin to look at it in that way?
I'll defer to the Assistant Commissioner on this one.
Well, all I wanted to do is add a little context, because early part of this year, the DPP publicly spoke about a caution matrix that he wanted to introduce to allow us to caution people for minuscule amounts of weed, and we actually have that caution matrix. And my note to self is to look at how many times that caution matrix have been applied so we can address the issues that Mr. Simmons talked about, the unintended consequences of criminalizing young men who then, you know, they become a problem later, because if they can't go off to school, if they become criminalized and all this stuff happens, well, we're dealing with a long-term criminal. So we need to look at that and look at how we've applied the caution matrix. And the question of whether or not there need to be changes in laws, I'm sorry, I have to give that back to the Minister.
I'd like to jump in and make a comment about that, if I may. With this announcement by the DPP earlier this year about this cautioning people for simple possession, well, the commissioner or the police then came out and said that there is such a thing as a matrix and the person has to fit into it. So I've had a few clients who've been arrested for simple possession, and I've then called the police and said, well, you know, what's the caution matrix? I had to actually try to do some detective work of my own to find out that, A, there was a caution matrix. I then asked them for a copy of the caution matrix. I got the emails to prove that. I've asked the commissioner or the police people quite a few times and have been told I can't have it. I've gone back to the DPP to ask him what is the policy. He announced it to the media, but he doesn't have it to produce it in writing, at least to the defense bar, so that we could advise our clients. I even asked him if it was a state secret, and so we still don't have it. And so maybe we need to use this Stop and Search Terrorism Act to try and get it from the police. But it would be very helpful. Be very helpful if the police could actually tell the public what the matrix is. Yeah. So I ask the commissioner now, can you give an assurance that you'll be able to publicize the matrix to the public or the defense bar so that we know what we're all talking about?
I don't think it's that difficult. It's 3 grams or under. And if you're a first-time offender, and if you're accepting possession, so if you said it wasn't mine, we can't caution you. Those are the real three basic elements to it. So if it's under 3 grams, and you admit it's yours and you're a first-time offender, I personally had, Mr. Simmons can attest to that, he's brought somebody to me and said, I think this person is a good candidate. And, you know, I went on a limb and we applied the caution matrix.
So what's so hard about telling defense lawyers that all this time?
Well, I want to say something really quickly, because I don't want people to think that this is just about people getting stopped with marijuana. When a person gets pulled over, a young person in particular, it can go one of 4 or 5 ways. They can be fully cooperative, and be found with nothing and be released shortly thereafter. They can become confrontational, and this can happen for several reasons. One, why the heck are you stopping me because I ain't done nothing and I can't see why I'm being pulled over and others aren't. They can be guilty of some sort of a crime, some minor crime, not a serious crime, i.e. Extended warrants, possession of small amounts of marijuana, so on and so forth, or they could be guilty of a serious crime. Majority of people fall in not the last category, so they're either being confrontational, meaning that if we haven't had any education to our young people about these new powers, and all of a sudden they're getting pulled over left, right, and center, and they put it down to discrimination, racism, you know it, that leaves them open to interpret and behave as many people would, not being informed. And so, again, whose job is it to make sure that they are informed, and are we setting our people up to fail if we don't inform them before we bring in legislation? When it comes... And so that becomes a serious issue. When it comes to marijuana, it needs to be at a higher level than just giving it to the police. And I'll explain to you why. When a person gets pulled over for a small amount of marijuana, they are booked, they're given a court date. They go to court and they plead guilty or not guilty for possession of drugs. Usually in the courtroom, there's a person from the media jotting down names to report and make news for that night. That information is normally lifted from somehow from the newspaper and used to feed into a database for basically an international stop list to the United States, and what we're finding more and more often is being adopted by Canada. Now, when you are born and raised in a 22 square mile island, the inability to travel to the two largest continents next to you is a big, big deal. And when you're 16 years old and that happens and you don't have the money to obtain a lawyer, because most of the kids who have money, the affluent kids, they don't fall in this category because they have the lawyers that can go and make the argument, and it's a reasonable argument. My point is simple. By the time that name gets put in the newspaper, whether they're convicted or not, it doesn't matter. They have already been put on the stop list by the United States Department. They have categorically said to me, Mr. Simmons, your government needs to change its laws. So the only way to address this is by the government changing its own laws. They've explained to me that they have laws in the U.S. that they deal with these types of matters outside of a court system, so that even a suspended sentence, even something where they say, okay, well, we're not going to charge you, it doesn't qualify. The minute conditional discharge doesn't qualify. So it has to come from a legislative point of view. So I hope after tonight, knowing all the facts, that we can actually put legislation in place to either decriminalize or make it illegal for the media to print names. Otherwise, the long-term effects affecting our young boys will continue and it will get worse.
All right, do we have another question from the floor?
Yeah, I just wanted to enlarge on that a bit because with the American Consul General, I've been made to understand that it's not the conviction that causes the person to be put on a sanction list. It is the admission of guilt. So we'd have to derive a process by which the individual does not enter the judicial system at all, and that would call for some legislative enactments to keep them outside of the legal system.
Let's go here.
Yes. Good night. Good night to everybody.
Yes.
I'm not sure if I feel cool. Is it really cool enough?
Oh,
okay. All right, cool. Because as I sat there and I listened to Mr. Masterton make his presentation, I felt a little disheartened that he will make light or highlight with much humor the fact that his law firm is getting so much acquittals, you know, because it only... You know, especially in these times and what we're facing, you know, is in severe contraction with the very force that is deemed to keep our streets safe. And he can make mention of it in a boastful manner like every day in school, and I just thought that was very distasteful, Mr. Masterton. Uh-huh. Yes. But to Mr. Cordell O'Reilly and Mr. Carlton Simmons and Mr. Martin, I thought your presentations were very insightful and very awesome. you know. And especially highlighting the repercussions as to what this legislation has brought about. When this legislation was first brought about, I was very disturbed because I thought to myself that it was just a band-aid approach to appease the people of this community to say that, you know, we're willing to take certain means and measures to address, you know, the same sort of crimes that you deem that it met. But unfortunately, you know, and especially listening to one of the highlights that Mr. Cordell Riley made, that I believe it was Mr. Riley, that the UK has done away with the same legislation that now you have bestowed upon this community. And it only, from listening to them three gentlemen's name that I mentioned, only confirms what I'm been deeming as, or alluding to all this time within myself. And that one of the only reasons that I can figure that you were still hurled onto this legislation after seeing the negative results that it's having on our community, if it's not become a revenue stream for the government now, meaning to say, with the outcome in the courts and the fines and everything else that goes with it, it's become a revenue booster. And this is one of the reasons I'm questioning myself, saying, if the UK has done away with it and you all are so ready to adopt policy and legislation from the UK, why not you abolish it? And if you are so genuinely wanting to tackle this problem, it only hammers home the reason why you haven't adopted one of the other policies and legislations that the UK have implemented, and that is decriminalization. So it again hammers home to me the aspect of the revenue stream that this whole thing has created on the downside of it. And I just want to leave it right there.
You've raised some issues and you've posed some questions within your comment. Anyone want to address it right now?
Sure, I'd like.
And then we will have a question, gentlemen, this side.
Sure, I'd like to say to the gentleman that I apologize to you and to anybody else if you took offense by that. So I just wanted to say that. And thanks for pointing that out.
You better apologize to me, sir, as our community.
Right.
You know, because economics takes stand in a lot of you all's motive for doing things. Hear me? And to know a man in our society is guilty until proven innocent. You know, and to know that you can make that statement up there, and yes, I don't know if a gentleman's guilty, but in a lot of cases, the writing's on the wall to say, we've got a lot of murderers that are running around out there right now that you and people like you are so willing to lay all your hinges on to get this person off, like, and I think that's just very distasteful for you to highlight it with such humor as you did tonight.
All right, points made.
Can I just question?
Hold one sec.
Yes.
Addressing the comment.
Well, I mean, the question of whether or not a law will be repealed is up to the government. But I think let's add some context. You're asking us to repeal a law, not apply a particular law. But rhetorically, the question to ask is: do we think that the application of that law by the police has had any impact in reducing the number of firearms incidents? What is the answer? Is the answer yes or no?
We don't know.
So, well, if you look at the charts, you can see.
The charts doesn't.
Just hold on a minute. You have an argument. Let me position mine. In 2010, we had 36 people either killed or injured. 2010. It started with 10 in the first quarter, 10 in the second quarter, 10 in the third quarter, and then 4 in the fourth quarter. Yeah, from firearms. So, when you look at the stop and search numbers, you saw the stop and search numbers going up in 2010. You're a statistician. So when you look at 2011, we started out with 5 in the first quarter. There'd been 4 in the second quarter, and there'd been 2 in the third quarter. So if you look at the numbers, it can tell you what reduction that is. If there were 36, that now is 11. So what is the question? So stop and search, does it work or does it work? Do you want us to stop? Do you want 36 people shot and killed? Or do you want us to apply stop and search?
You're basically saying there is a direct correlation.
There is a direct correlation between stop and search.
I'm sure, and I hear the buzzing. I'm quite sure Cordell is shaking his head. Bring the mics a little closer. We don't have a problem with the interaction, and we also have a question.
May I?
Yeah, and we're going to get back into that because there are some questions there. Yes.
Good evening, panel. We've heard a few of you mention terrorism and the Terrorist Act. I want to bring it back to the stop and search, but before I do that, I want to actually read you a quote from the New York Times on September 11th, 10-year anniversary, and there's a large study and a lot of debriefs obviously done. So I want to read you this quote, and then I want to get some response. Since 9/11, the criminal law has expanded, ensnaring as terrorists people who have done no more than provide humanitarian aid to needy families, while privacy and political freedoms have contracted, especially for those in Muslim communities. On the one hand, the past 10 years have shown that criminal law can be used effectively to fight terrorism. On the other, it has also demonstrated that the demand for prevention can all too quickly lead to the abuse of innocence. Does that resonate with any of you there, or is that a bridge too far?
Yeah. Thank you.
Just to touch on that, again, there's no data to say how many kids how many people had to call a family member to come and rescue their child as the father was put into a police car and led away as a result of this. How many girlfriends were left shaking their head, like, you know, why is it that my boyfriend has to be pulled over and stopped for no apparent reason? There's no data to show the negative effects that it's having on general ordinary people. We cannot downplay the psychological effects that this has on families and on people. Like I said, when I got pulled over and was asked to get out of the car and put my hands on the bonnet, and then they searched my pockets in public, people driving across, and then they went through my car and looked through it. They didn't find a thing. But how do you think I felt after that? Do you think I felt like a man, like a person? So this is what I'm talking about. We can't just say, well, you know, we stopped 20,000 people and we got 5 guns. Well, is that effective?
No. Cordell.
Yeah, I just want to respond to a couple of things. First of all, in 1994, Dr. Dorothy Newman writing a report for the Department of Statistics entitled Stride Towards the 21st Century stated, and I paraphrase, that the lack of collecting proper data is, in a biracial country, is in and of itself institutionalized racism. Here we are 15 years later, and we still don't have the data that will prove causality. That data that was shown there is not robust enough to make that kind of determination. We don't collect that information. Now, in fact, CURB had been pushing for just the simple data in terms of the race of the individuals, the age, and all of that, and to no avail. I saw Senator Donkley in the room. He's going now. And then one day in the press, we read, somebody calls me up and says, look, the data you've been requested is there, because it went through the parliamentary question procedure, and that's how the data came forth. So we don't have the data that shows that there is causality, meaning the impact of the police is reducing crime. Mayor Bloomberg, not Bloomberg, Rudy Giuliani, made that same statement with regards to decreasing crime in the United States, in New York City. And when the economists looked at the data, only 35% of it could be applied to what was actually the police were doing to reduce crime. The other 60% came from the abortion, the Roe versus Wade, whereby persons, before Roe versus Wade, you had to have the child if you didn't want it. After Roe versus Wade, you can, effectively abort the problem so that 20 years later, you have a reduction in crime. So we don't have the kind of robust statistics that's going to show us that the actions of the police are, in fact, reducing crime. The other thing I want to point out is that the minister stated that the laws are not being abused by the police force, and he may have data which suggests that. I don't. But the data that I do have indicates that in 2008, there were less than 1,000 stop and searches under 315F to about 19,000 this year. Now, how do you get from less than 1,000 to 19,000 in 4 years? Well, I'll give you my theory. You can answer it. It would be good to know. But my theory, we've heard is that these hot spots have turned out to be, in some instances, the entire island, which means that if you are under 315F and the entire island is under is a hot spot, that means that anybody in Bermuda could be stopped and searched without probable cause. Now, that tells me how your data can go from less than 1,000 to almost 20,000 in 4 years. I'm finished. Thank you.
The reason why you can look at that data, well, I mean, you're a statistician, I'm not, but the data is relative and recent. You'll see the number of people that have been injured or killed from firearms, and it's there. 36 in 2010. Stop and searches went off the roof. Yes, we agree. They went off the roof because on Good Friday 2010, we heard the community. We heard people that were in such a panic about what Bermuda was coming to that we had to take action. And we've increased the amount of enforcement to address the rise in gun violence. And as the rise in enforcement has gone up, the number of arrests have gone up, we've seen a decrease. We've seen public satisfaction is saying we're satisfied with what the police are doing. And yet you tell me that you don't think what the police are doing is having any effect. I mean, that can't be a reasonable argument. It must be linked that what the police are doing with stopping searches having some effect and reducing the number of deaths from firearms. And that's our job.
Excuse me. May I just interject?
Use the mic.
Is it on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's on.
Okay. Cool. Is it possible to clarify how many of those 19,000 stops were under Section 315F? Because that's a very important consideration. Are all 19,000 searches under that provision the one that doesn't require you to have reasonable suspicion, or is that an aggregation of all of the stops that you do, which could be under other legislation? Can you clarify that, please?
Yes, the stop and search form. Stop and or search forms, because the impression that the form gives is that everybody that stops to search, but some of the stops are for traffic-related incidents. We did a sample that we wanted to make sure we were able to provide some of the statistics. And based on our DIP sample, yes, the vast majority of these people that are stopped and or searched are searched on the 315F.
Lady?
Okay. I just want to say that I have been subjected to two searches in the last 2 years. The first one was under 315F, Section 315F. It was the police officers did say that that's why they were stopping and searching me. They searched my car, they searched my purse. They didn't search my body. I became very angry because it was a very random search, and it looked like it appeared to be that they were profiling at the time. I didn't take any recourse at that time. The second time I was with two persons the first time. Going to a reggae concert, I guess that's why they stopped me. However, the second time was in recent months. I was on my own. I had just dropped a friend off. And I decided to drive along a certain area. I was stopped There were four policemen there. The person that was checking my license was a female Bermudian. The fourth policeman was down further before I got to get stopped. But there was a British officer. He was pleasant. And there was a non-Bermudian officer who was in charge of the road stop. Halfway through them checking my license, he instructed them that I was going to be searched. He did not mention any section 315F. I could see my home from where I was. He did not give me any reason why I would be searched. He didn't say what type of search I was going to get. I immediately felt concerned and apprehensive because I was a female, and he was deferring to the female officer, who I detected was reluctant to proceed with any type of search. So they prolonged coming back to me, and when she did come back to me, she just gave me my license and told me to move along. My concern was that I wasn't prepared to be searched. I was going to tell him, you need to follow me straight to the police station and explain to your senior officer why you want to search me. Because I'm not going to be searched on a public road. And like the gentleman said there, you know, it's very undaunting. It's very embarrassing. I'm a public figure. I work in a high school with young people. And the first thing I was thinking about, this was one of my students, my male students. I have cautioned them to at least understand how to act when they are stopped, but I was angry. I did have some recourse. I did take it further. I reported it to a senior officer who was really upset because he knew me, and he felt, well, why did they even proceed with that? And so they said they would talk to their officers that were out on the street searching. But I feel that the law was an invasion of my privacy. It was invasive. It was ambitious. It's very ambitious. It's not needed. And I'm a regular citizen who's been a law-abiding practically all my life. And why would I be stopped? And why, you know, it really, really put me in another place. It took me about 2 weeks to get it sorted out. That policeman who ordered the search didn't realize my connections to the police force. I have family members that have senior officers in the police force. One of them did get involved at the end of the process. But I was very, very upset about the way that the procedure was handled. What about the average person who doesn't know how to stand up for themselves? What kind of recourse do they have? And is there something that the police service can do to educate people about the Section 315F and recourse, and what recourse they can take if they feel that they're being abused, if there's an abuse of power?
To the panel, that is a very broad comment and perhaps typifies some of the complaint we hear on the talk shows. And outside of the minister, if you would, and the acting commissioner, perhaps this would warrant some response across the board reflecting on that. Gentlemen.
Can I just say that the same section allows for you to write in and ask for a report or a statement to say that you were searched? Now, I'm not sure exactly what's supposed to be in the statement or like if it's supposed to give you a particular reason, but I would expect that it would, right? And so you have 12 months to do it. So even for when you have been stopped already, you can still ask for a written statement as to why you have been searched. And maybe the commissioner could say whether or not people have been asking and whether they have been getting it.
I'd just like to point out that when we started to look at Stop and Search, one of our aims was to do a Know Your Rights campaign. But when we got the legal opinion back, we discovered that if you're being stopped under 315F, you effectively have no rights.
2006 PACE Act gives you some rights because there has to be a reasonable, some reasonable suspicion with regards to 2000 and PACE. So you can say, well, you know, what is it that, you know, which act are you using? What are you, you know, you have some rights there. But if they're using 315-aft, effectively, you have no rights.
Can I just answer? In terms, I mean, the job of the police, and certainly my regular role as a deputy commissioner, I'm responsible for discipline, and I see Michelle St. Jean with her hands up. She was the chairman of the Police Complaints Authority, and we would certainly advocate the senior command to any member of the public that feels that a police officer has not treated them in a way that's civil. First of all, civil, not even illegally civil, to make a complaint to the Police Complaints Authority or to a police. Because we spend a lot of time reminding our staff that we need the community to support us. So we give you these powers on the 315F, but we expect you to be civil and we expect you to apply them in a civil and fair manner. And there's sometimes, I will admit, that some of our police officers sometimes don't always apply it. We want to know when that happens, and we certainly will investigate and provide the necessary guidance to the police officers that don't apply. Because we need people like you, Ms. Jackson, that will come out when they see a crime and report it to us. So if we alienate you, then how are we going to solve crime? And, you know, everywhere there's always a rogue policeman. But if we're doing 2,000 stops a month, I don't know how many complaints we've got coming in. Very, very few complaints are coming in. Very few times we are having the kind of violent response that Carlton talks about. We're seeing low numbers in terms of response. Can we do a little bit better job of educating our staff? Yes, we can. We need to recognize again that, you know, let our police officers understand that when they deal with the public, this is the effect that it has, so that they can apply it with a little bit more context. When you stop a young man and he appears angry, yeah, he might be because he's been stopped 10 times already this week. Doesn't mean that you need to go and arrest him because he may be shouted or cursed. Those are things that we are building even in our new training program so that our officers understand the impact of the powers that they have. I always operated from a principle in the 30 years I've been a policeman, is that my brother or sister, how would they feel if they got stopped? And I always treated people that way, and we encourage our staff to treat people that way. You have the power, yeah, but you don't have to be nasty to people. And, you know, we expect that when a member of the public challenges us, we provide the context of the laws that they apply. And so in the case where you ask, why are you searching me? Even though, as Cardell is saying, we have an absolute power, but you would expect common sense would prevail in terms of applying that. If you don't look like you're Kangpanger, why do they want to search you unless they had some of the reason? So this is what we would expect. And the dialogue with CURB and now with the Center for Justice is good. Because of the police service, we hear this. So even though I might sound like I'm defending 315S, because I know it's a very good tool to deal with the gang problem, we recognize that the unintended consequences, as Carlton spoke about, are occurring. And we need to make sure that there's some balance for us in terms of how we
can. I just elaborate on that? I cannot sit here and pretend that there's not a bigger problem than we would like to think. I'm 34 years old. I'm currently in the process of my third encounter with the Bermuda Police Service. No, it's not to say that I think that they are not doing a great job. What I am saying is that most young men don't have the education, the resources, and the knowledge of their rights to stand up for themselves, and that's probably why we don't see more complaints. When I was 21, I was actually arrested, went to court, and was found by the courts that I was wrongfully arrested. It cost me $5,000 to do so. You know how much money I got back after they said I was wrongfully arrested? Zero. So why on earth would somebody, just to keep their name clear, spend $5,000 they may or may not have, just to keep their name clear? So we need to, when we see issues in the law that prevent people from actually exercising their rights, we need to address them. That's why they have civil courts in the U.S. to allow people to be compensated when people are wrongfully or unjustly incarcerated, so that they do have a reason to fight for their rights. I was also stopped maybe 2 years ago, a year and a half ago now, by a police officer. I was put in handcuffs while I was sitting on a bike. I have no criminal record. I've never been arrested for a crime. I'm known to the community and the public. When I made the complaint about this to the Independent Police Authority, I got a letter about 4 months later saying that we've reviewed. I was never interviewed. They just took a statement that I had already written to make the complaint, reviewed it, and just sent me a letter back in the mail saying under Pace law he didn't do anything wrong. And I'm saying, well, how could he have not done anything wrong? I was stopped. I was put in handcuffs. When I refused to sign a ticket, I was yanked off my bike, put into jail for about 4 hours until I caught a lawyer. How is, and never convicted of any crime. So how is it? It's nothing wrong with that. And even now, there's an incident that's ongoing, which I won't speak about, but my point is, it's not as simple as you just have the right to speak out. The Independent Police Authority has a budget, or at least had a budget, of less than $100,000. The Bermuda Police Service just has a budget of what? You know, come on. How many million? This is a direct question. I'm not being funny, because I'm trying to show you what we have given to the watchdog and what we have given to the dog, so to speak. Now, I don't mean it like that. But the point is, the police have a lot more resources, and so we've given one or two people in an office the entire powers of actually policing the police with less money than it would cost to hire one individual. This is what I'm talking about. You can't have a balanced situation. So from our point of view, it's not about repealing the law, but maybe if you're not going to repeal the law, then put in place the other necessary steps to mitigate the effects that, and I'm hoping, it is my absolute sincere hope that after today, legislation will be tabled to ensure that more young boys don't get put on the stop list for no apparent, no good reason.
All right. We are in wind down mode. We started a bit late, rain delayed, if you wish. Minister, in some closing remarks before we ask Mr. Sean Morris, the chairman of the Center for Justice, to come up and just conclude the proceedings.
Yeah, first of all, I want to thank the panel for raising some very emotive questions, things that perhaps as a legislator we don't consider on the front end of enacting legislation. Nevertheless, I want people to recognize that as a member of the government, there's a responsibility to react, if you like, to acts of violence. We have to protect our community, all of our community. Gun crime has introduced into the criminal situation a new paradigm. And if someone wants to liken the legislation to that that's similar to terrorism, may I say this, that there is a parallel that this country has seen to terrorism in other countries. As we look at the scope of the implementation of Section 315F, yes, consider Bermuda to be an entire zone that's under threat. Many of you are able to go about your jobs untouched by crime because of the effectiveness of the police. I don't see in the audience or on this panel a representation of the very people, the victims, and those people who are locked into the gun violence of which we speak, which causes so much discomfort among civil libertarians. I say that not in a snide way, but I would say to anyone who wants to change the paradigm of crime, who wish to deal and help young people to adjust in this society and to protect the society, to get out into the highways and byways, go into the areas that are impacted by crime, such as the police must do, and then you'll see what the real problems are in this country. I say that with a great degree of seriousness and a great degree of resolve. We have to act with the legislation that we have. We have to deal in a pragmatic way with the facts as they are presented. People are still dying. Young black men are dying. And while it may sound very nice and patronizing to want to represent them, a true representation would be to remove the reasons that they act the way they do and to help them and protect them from themselves. There's an unenviable task that the police and the government have to carry out. And I would hope that you would assist as members of the public in caring citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. We This has been an intriguing discussion. We'd ask Mr. Sean Morris to come up and just give some parting remarks.
Thank you, Rick. Just on behalf of the Board of Directors of the Center of Justice, I'd just like to thank our panelists for coming out tonight, and thank you, the audience, for participating in this very important forum. Thank each of the panelists for your different views and perspectives that you presented. You've been an engaging audience, and we thank you all for your participation. I'm sure this is not the last time we'll have a discussion on this stuff in Search Files of the Police. And with that, I just want to thank all of you for coming out. Thank you. I'd just like to thank also our moderator, Rick Richardson, for doing the fine job. Thank you.
We need to keep talking.
We will. Safe journeys.
We'll get close to the game. We're not in the mood.
No.
We can talk about some of this stuff.